Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Tracy McClure and I'll be with you over the next half hour. Coming up on the program today, Pope Francis's visit to Assisi at the conclusion of an international prayer gathering for peace and his tough words on the shame of war at Mass at Santa Marta. Plus, we go back in time to revisit chief moments of Pope Francis's apostolic journey to the United States 1 year ago, his historic speeches to Congress and the United Nations. And we remember his visit to Ground Zero and speak to the architect who rebuilt the site following the September 11th terror attacks of 15 years ago. Tuesday, September 20th, Pope Francis was in the Italian hill town of Assisi, the home of his namesake, St. Francis, where he participated at the conclusion of a four-day international interfaith summit for prayers for peace. The event, organized by the Franciscans and the lay community Sant'Egidio, was first convened by Pope St. John Paul II in 1986 and has brought thousands of religious leaders from dozens of faiths together to dialogue and offer prayers for world peace. Chris Altieri was in Assisi this year for Pope Francis's visit. He brings us this report.
Siamo venuti ad Assisi come pellegrini in cerca di pace.
We have come to Assisi as pilgrims in search of peace, said Pope Francis to the gathering of more than 400 leaders from dozens of different traditions of faith and religion. We carry within us and place before God the hopes and sorrows of many persons and peoples. We thirst for peace. We desire to witness to peace.
Abbiamo soprattutto bisogno.
Above all, said Pope Francis, we need to pray for peace, because peace is God's gift, and it lies with us to plead for it, embrace it, and build it every day with God's help. Before the closing ceremony, the Holy Father delivered a meditation on peace to a gathering of leaders from various Christian churches and ecclesial communities in the lower basilica of St. Francis.
Di fronte a Gesù crocifisso.
Before Christ crucified, the power and wisdom of God. We Christians are called to contemplate the mystery of love not loved, and to pour out mercy upon the world, Pope Francis told the ecumenical gathering of Christian leaders come together to hear his meditation in the lower basilica.
Sulla croce, albero di vita, il male è stato trasformato in bene.
On the cross, the tree of life, continued Pope Francis, evil was transformed into good. Much has changed in the three decades that have passed since Pope St. John Paul II held the first event here in Assisi. The Cold War has ended while the shadow of international terrorism has grown and spread, and our failure to exercise good stewardship over creation has created new challenges to peace. The spirit of Assisi, however, remains unchanged, and each of us has a part to play in realizing the hope for peace that animates this event. Here, 30 years ago, recalled Pope Francis in concluding his remarks, Pope St. John Paul II said, "Peace is a workshop, open to all, and not just to specialists, savants, and strategists. Peace is a universal responsibility." In Assisi, for the World Day of Prayer for Peace, I'm Chris Altieri.
Earlier Tuesday, at his customary morning mass at the Santa Marta guest house here in the Vatican, the Pope said the world needs to go beyond the divisions of religions and feel the shame of war, without turning a deaf ear to the cries of those who are suffering. There is no God of war.
Non esiste Dio di guerra.
War, the inhumanity of a bomb that explodes, killing and injuring people, and cutting off humanitarian aid so that it cannot get to children, the elderly, the sick. These things are uniquely the work of the devil, said Pope Francis. For this, it is necessary for all faiths to pray, even cry out for peace, united in the conviction that God is a God of peace. At the start of his homily, Pope Francis observed he and men and women of all religions would be in Assisi Tuesday to pray for peace, and he recalled his letter to the bishops of the world calling on them to organize prayer meetings, inviting all men and women of goodwill of any religion to pray for peace, because, he exclaimed, the world is at war, the world is suffering. Pope Francis said, if we shut our ears to the cry of those suffering under the bombs of war and those who suffer the exploitations of arms dealers, it may be that when it happens to us, we will not be heard. We do not see the war, he said. We are scared by some act of terrorism, but the bombs are falling day and night. The war is not far away. It is very close, he said, and touches everyone. War begins in the heart. May the Lord grant us peace in our hearts, Pope Francis prayed. May he take away all desire for greed, covetousness, for fighting. There can be no divisions between faiths. It is not enough to simply thank God because perhaps the war is not affecting us. We must also think about the others who are being affected by it. And while we pray today, it would be nice if all of us were to feel ashamed of this.
Sarebbe bello che ognuno di noi senta vergogna.
That humans, our brothers, are capable of doing this. Today, he said, a day of prayer, penance, crying for peace, a day to hear the cry of the poor, this cry that opens the heart to compassion, to love, and saves us from selfishness. Go back in time now to 1 year ago when Pope Francis was on his first apostolic visit to the United States for the 8th World Meeting of Families in Philadelphia. On September 24, 2015, Pope Francis became the first Roman Catholic pontiff ever to address a joint session of the United States Congress. He was the third pope to address such a senior legislative body. Only John Paul II and Benedict XVI had delivered discourses to parliaments in Poland and Germany, respectively. Chris Altieri was in Washington with Pope Francis for that historic address. We listen back now to his report.
Focused on four iconic figures from U.S. history, the 16th and arguably greatest U.S. president, Abraham Lincoln, the radical social activist and servant of God, Dorothy Day, the Protestant preacher and civil rights leader Martin Luther King, Jr., and Thomas Merton, the Trappist monk, author, and spiritual adventurer, the speech essentially reminded legislators of their duty to respond to the basic political question, how ought we to order our lives together, in light of a common commitment to pursue the common good. A good political leader, Pope Francis said, is one who, with the interests of all in mind, seizes the moment in a spirit of openness and pragmatism.
A good political leader is one who, with the interests of all in mind, seizes the moment in a spirit of openness and pragmatism.
Pope Francis did not shy away from difficult issues, and he did not mince words. He reminded legislators of their duty in justice to assure that human life be respected in its dignity at every stage of its development, and he frankly expressed his concern for the family.
I cannot hide my concern for the family, which is threatened, perhaps as never before, from within and without.
He also recalled his audience to the urgency of the need for recovery and repair of the national discourse in light of the better angels of the American character
and with an eye to the future. A nation can be considered great, he said, when it defends liberty as Lincoln did, when it fosters a culture which enables people to dream of full rights for all their brothers and sisters, as Martin Luther King sought to do, when it strives for justice and the cause of the oppressed, as Dorothy Day did by her tireless work, the fruit of a faith which becomes dialogue and sows peace in the contemplative style of Thomas Merton. In a word, Pope Francis continued to give sign of his profoundly Catholic forma mentis, both in the capital and lowercase sense of the word. His willingness to learn and listen, and his belief in the ability of human beings to achieve great things in service of the true and genuine good, if they are receptive to grace and willing to hear each other respectfully, with a healthy regard at once for the frailty and brokenness of our nature and the divine glory in the image and likeness of which that nature has been cast. I'm Chris Ultieri.
On September 25th of that year, Pope Francis followed in the footsteps of Blessed Paul VI to address the General Assembly of the United Nations in New York. He was the fourth pope to do so. Saint Pope John Paul II had addressed the assembly twice before him, and Benedict XVI had delivered a discourse to the ambassadors and heads of states there in 2008. Sean Patrick Lovett was with Pope Francis and looks back for us in this report.
Depression, that's what I felt as I listened to Pope Francis address the United Nations General Assembly in New York. Not because of what he said or how he said it. On the contrary, the speech is a masterpiece in content and style. What depressed me was how much of what he said had already been said in different ways and with different words from the very same podium by three of his predecessors, Paul VI, John Paul II, and Benedict XVI. Nostalgia, that's what I felt as I listened to Pope Francis quote from Paul VI's address to the United Nations in 1965. He did so three times. Phrases like the need to reflect on our common destiny, to build modern civilization on spiritual principles, and the eerie reminder that the real danger comes from man ring as relevantly today as they did when they were first pronounced right here exactly 50 years ago. Hence the sense of depression. How is it that despite these words of wisdom, encouragement, and solid common sense, the world is actually worse off now than it was then? Pope Francis listed what he called the scourges that afflict our civilization today. It's an ugly list, and I hate repeating it, but I feel I have to. Listen carefully. Religious and cultural persecution, war and weapons proliferation, irresponsibility towards the environment, human trafficking, the marketing of human organs, the sexual exploitation of children, the arms trade, drug trafficking, slave labor, money laundering, international organized crime, the culture of waste. All of these are ghastly examples of what Pope Francis describes so effectively as the darkness of the disorder caused by unrestrained ambitions and collective forms of selfishness.
La oscuridad del desorden causado por las ambiciones descontroladas y los egoísmos colectivos.
Prophetic. That's what I felt the Pope sounded like as he addressed the most powerful and influential men and women on our planet, when he told them, told us, that we cannot postpone certain agendas for the future, that we need to set aside partisan and ideological interests and strive to serve the common good. A lonely figure dressed in white, Pope Francis not only sounded like a prophet, he looked like one too. Unfortunately, we all know how the world treats prophets.
Well, no visit to New York would have been the same without a moment of prayer for the victims of the September 11th terror attacks of 2001 at Ground Zero. Pope Francis did just that, meeting with representatives of the city's main religious communities. Susie Hodges takes us back to that day, September 25th, 2015. In After praying silently for the victims, the Pope laid a white rose at the edge of one of the two massive waterfall pools where the names of those who died are inscribed. The Pope then met the family members of some of those victims of the 9/11 attacks. Many of them were firefighters and other rescue workers who had gone to the scene after the planes crashed into the Twin Towers and then lost their lives when the towers collapsed. Afterwards, the Pope headed below ground to the National September 11th Museum for an interfaith meeting that was attended by 12 religious leaders, including a rabbi and an imam from New York. In his address to the gathering, Pope Francis said Ground Zero was a place where we shed tears when thinking of those who were the victims of a mindset which knows only violence, hatred and revenge. This is a place, he went on, where we weep out of a sense of helplessness in the face of injustice, murder, and the failure to settle conflicts through dialogue.
Today, we cry the pain,
the powerlessness makes us feel when we see injustice, fratricide, the inability to solve our differences.
Pope Francis said he hoped their presence together will be a powerful sign of their shared desire to be a force for reconciliation in this community and throughout the world. He went on to warn against attempts to create a rigid uniformity, saying we can and must build unity on the basis of our diversity of languages, cultures and religions. Together, he continued, we are called to say no to every attempt to impose uniformity and yes to a diversity accepted and reconciled. However, he pointed out that this can only happen if we uproot from our hearts all feelings of hatred, vengeance and resentment.
Daniel Libeskind was the world-renowned architect chosen in 2003 to redevelop the Ground Zero site. His Freedom Tower and reflection pools at One World Trade Center have replaced the gaping holes left by the Twin Towers when they came crashing down. On a visit to Rome, Daniel Libeskind shared his vision of his work with Veronica Scarisbrick.
Ground Zero is a hugely important project because that is a project that is not about a museum or a single building, but about shaping a new neighborhood after such a catastrophe. And it's not just about shaping it in some simply physical and functional sense, which it has to be as well, but creating a sense of what it means to create foundations of memory, which are at the same time foundations for liberty and freedom. And in that project, which is a vast project, one of the largest in the world, I really created something very unique, based on social space, based on creating a sacred space in a center of a, you know, piece of real estate. Nothing sacred has been declared. And most of my great colleagues, architects, built in the center of this site large buildings. But I decided after, because I started with the families of victims, never to build where people perished, that even though it was part of the competition, I decided this should be something very special. Should be where we have a park, where we have the footprints, the waterfalls, which screen the sight, the sounds of busy streets of New York and give intimacy to experience. And not just on the surface of the street, but all the way 75 feet down to bedrock, which will be the museum itself, so that we can feel the impact and the sense of where the slurry wall, that great foundation, which is the dam between the Hudson River and the rest of New York, had it collapsed, all of the New York subways would have been flooded. So I created really a new sense of the center of Lower Manhattan, of Manhattan. And then I created emblematic buildings. The buildings really I shaped around that site so that there's sun and light on the site. And buildings from the Tower Number 1, Freedom Tower, symbolic, 1776, date of the Declaration of Independence, really form a torch in a spiral formation that refers to what I saw when I immigrated to New York, the Torch of Liberty, just at the south, standing south of the site, which is on which is inscribed, you know, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled mess of yearning to be free. It's about immigrants, it's about New Yorkers, it's about the people from all over the world who come poor, uneducated to the city. And I created some other specialized devices. I created a new public space called the Wedge of Light, which especially incorporates St. Paul's Church. St. Paul's Church, which was so important in the first efforts when the site was totally devastated, became an emblematic and practical center point of emergency help. I incorporated into the Wedge of Light, which is determined by two angles of light, 8:46, September 11th, when the first tower was struck, and 10:28 a.m. when the second tower collapsed. That's shaped in light and includes, of course, St. Paul's Church, which is one of the oldest churches in New York, and it's the church where George Washington and the founders of the country came to pray in after being inaugurated as the first president right at the Federal Center a few blocks from this building. So the site is full of meaning, and you have to remember that the site is between Church Street, Liberty Street. Those two words, how amazing. In New York, we have the sense of togetherness, and that's rebuilding of New York is not rebuilding just some buildings, but really a new neighborhood.
For Libeskind, the concepts of religious freedom and liberty go hand in hand and are reflected in his works, which he says build bridges between communities.
Religious freedom, the ability to be tolerant, the ability to see that the world is not just driven by violence and by denigration of the individual, but by liberty. What could be more important in our time than this topic?
I know you're of Jewish-Polish descent. How does that personal history play into this?
Well, I think greatly. My parents were both Holocaust survivors. I grew up under communism in Poland until we were able to leave. So to me, it's not an abstract. It's not a story that I read about and researched in books. It's something that I experienced, what it means, what genocides mean, what totalitarianism means. I don't take liberty for granted, as many people do. I think it's something we have to strive for every day, and we have to be conscious of all the forces in the world that are here.
Do you feel a special responsibility as one of the key players in architecture and the art world, in a sense, in terms of building bridges between peoples?
I think every architect should be a bridge builder between peoples. I think architecture is about a shared social space. It's about creating a space that people can be together. It's the greatest vehicle for communicating the fact that humanity is at one in this world. Of course, I think every piece of architecture has to deal with something which is positive. As I often said, this is the only profession, architecture, where pessimists are not required, because you can be pessimist almost in any other field. As a politician, as an economist, as a general, even a musical composer or a writer. But you can never be a pessimist as an architect, because architecture always lays foundations for a better future. And that is why architecture is so deeply implicated in faith, because you have to believe in something in order to build it.
Do you draw inspiration from sacred architecture at all?
Absolutely. I think it's hard to even divide, so to speak, sacred and secular, because in some way the divinity of light, the world, it's not just a practical and materialistic entity. We are all implicated in something which is greater than ourselves. So I think architects throughout history have always delved into things that go beyond just the world of function, the world of utility, the world of us. It is always informed by light, by proportion, by what is the idea of material? What is the world about? What are the questions that the world raises towards us and towards the way we live?
You talk about this contact with the real world. Architects are artists, so they speak about wonder and about beauty. It's difficult to find a link there between reality and wonder, no?
No, I think if you lose the sense that reality is wondrous, you will just build commodities and things that really are hollow. I think one has to reassert in every project, however modest, however small, the wondrous nature of the world, the wondrous nature of where we are and why we are and where we are looking and the horizons that are here. It's something truly inspiring.
When you went to the Sistine Chapel, invited by Pope Benedict, I think it was 2009, with a group of other artists, he asked you to be custodians of beauty. Is that difficult?
Well, it's a fantastic mission, But to be a custodian of beauty, that's true, because those words like beauty and truth and good and the good are not hollow words. They have become maybe cliches, and maybe most people don't even believe in them. But I do believe them. There are beautiful spaces. Architecture without beauty would not be architecture, and without truth and goodness, what would we be doing here? Nothing.
So there's a spiritual side to your inspiration. Where do you draw that inspiration from?
I think architecture, despite its heaviness, despite the fact that it's made out of very heavy materials, is a spiritual art. There's no doubt about it. It has always been a spiritual art, because to build is to assert a spirit of the world, a spirit of what is beyond. There is no dividing line between what people call secular and sacred today, because every worker, every person who contributes to the city is involved in something greater than themselves. So I always considered the city itself as the grandest of works of art, because it's created by so many people, mostly anonymous, and across such a great distance of time as well, not only today, but we are standing on the shoulders of giants of the past. So yes, we are implicated in something much more fantastic than many people are aware of.
You have built, though, a lot of Holocaust memorials, haven't you?
I have built the Jewish Museum in Berlin. I have built the Danish Jewish Museum, which deals with a totally different story of Danish Jews and the fact that they were saved by their countrymen. So it's a story that has a really positive sense of the spirit during a very, very dark period of total darkness, which is the Holocaust. Of course, I've been involved in a number of projects, but I've also been involved in many other kinds of projects with different religions and with different countries.
What drives you from an aesthetic point of view? Would it be more the wonder of beauty or the torment of the soul?
I don't think you can divide beauty from the torment of the soul, as you put it. I think the soul is a complex entity. And because you use the word soul, I think it's right. It's not. We don't only build for the eyes. We don't only build aesthetically for the sense of the external iconography, but for the deeper sense of the heart, which is implicated in every building. It's not just an intellectual experience. Beauty is not an intellectual experience only. It's a deep spiritual experience. And therefore, everything that has to do with human beings must go into it, including pain and suffering and the abyss that has been created by catastrophic murders. It's also part of the soul.
What artists have inspired you? I can see, for example, myself looking at some of your works, I can see, for example, Braque. Is that true, or is it just my idea?
No, I love the work of Braque. You're a very perceptive person. I love the work of Braque. I love the work of the early modern artists who created really almost a new language, which incorporates tradition but moves it forward to another dimension. But certainly I'm inspired by artists of all sorts and in all fields and also across the world, not only in Western art, but I'm inspired by Asian art, African art. We're so lucky to be able to have access to the world and learn so much from the extraordinary achievements of artists, musicians, composers, writers, filmmakers, poets, mathematicians and astronomers.
And that was world-renowned architect Daniel Libeskind speaking to Veronica Scarisbrick. And that brings us up to time today. You've been listening to Vatican Radio's English program, Vatican Weekend. I'm Tracy McClure, thanking you for joining me. Don't forget, you can hear this and many other programs on our website. You can find us on rv.va and by clicking on the English icon. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, so do check those out too. Until next time, bye-bye. Laudator Jesus Christus.